Hi, everyone. Welcome to More Podcast, Less Process. I am Jefferson Bailey, Strategic Initiatives Manager at Metropolitan New York Library Council. And with me is my co-host,
Josh Ranger. I don't live in Wisconsin, and I have never been there. And I work for AV Preserve. We're a consulting firm here in New York City. I'm senior consultant in charge of assessments and inventories.
Excellent. So,
thank you.
Cool.
And AV Preserve works with Metro, is very happy to partner with Metro on these types of projects.
So this is episode 6, so we're excited to have a number of people here from Center for Jewish History, and we're going to be talking about shared services and inter-institutional collaboration. And so I think they will do a better job of explaining what that means than I will. So how about everyone go around and introduce themselves?
I'm Rachel Miller, the Senior Manager for Archival Services at the Center.
I'm Melanie Myers. I'm the Senior References Services Librarian for Special Collections.
I'm Lauren Bradley. I'm the Systems Librarian.
And I'm Felicity Corkill, the Associate Conservator.
All right, great. Thank you all for being here. So who wants to start talking about, so CJH is sort of an interesting institution because it houses many repositories, and obviously we're going to talk about sort of the idea of shared services because there's a number of different collections with different collecting focuses and thematic orientation, and yet they share certain aspects of the archival enterprise across these different collections. So I guess tell us what the institutions are and how that works and what that sort of looks like from within the institution.
Sure. All right. So basically, the Center for Jewish History is the physical infrastructure and umbrella organization for 5 partner organizations with library, archives, and museum collections. And basically, our mission on behalf of the partners' collections focuses on access, first and foremost. So we provide support to the partners in the form of the following services: reference, systems, archival processing, conservation, digitization, and genealogy services. The center does not collect. It's solely up to the partners to collect. And the center, in turn, helps them provide access to those incoming materials. And the center's emphasis on access then frees up time and precious resources for the partners to focus on their collecting strengths and their individual missions. And each partner does still have staff that devotes time to some of the services that the center provides, especially on the archival processing and library cataloging end. But we have lifted much of the burden off of them. And basically, the partner organizations have separate bureaucracies, different work cultures, differing workflows. They handle their own academic and cultural programming, their own exhibitions. They have their own fundraising mechanisms. And they also have their own processing and digitization projects as well. So I guess I'd like to jump into a quick definition of each of the partners so you have a sense of all the different communities we're working with. The American Jewish Historical Society, which was founded in 1892, is the oldest national ethnic historical organization in the nation. And their archives and library collections reflect the history of the Jewish presence in the United States from the 1600s to the present. The American Sephardi Federation, which was founded in 1973, collects materials that document Sephardic communities from the Iberian Peninsula and the Balkans, as well as the Jews of North Africa and Muslim lands, including Iraq, Iran, and Yemen. And then we have the Leo Beck Institute, founded in 1955, which is devoted to the history of German-speaking Jews. And then there's the Yeshiva University Museum, which was founded in 73. And they're largely museum-oriented collections aimed to represent over 2,000 years of the aesthetic sensibilities of Jews living throughout the world. And the Ivo Institute for Jewish Research was founded in Vilna, in what was then Poland, in 1925, and then relocated to New York City in 1940. And their mission is to document the cultural history of Jewish life throughout Eastern Europe, Germany, and Russia. So we've got a very vibrant community of institutions, and basically the partners' library collections total more than 500,000 volumes, and their archival materials total approximately 30,000 linear feet. In terms of sort of the backdrop to the center's role here, as I understand it, the coming together of these various collecting repositories under one roof was the brainchild of the chair of YIVO's board back in the early 90s. And the center officially opened 13 years ago in October 2000. What played a formative role in determining the exact contours of the collaboration at the center was 6 years of NHPRC funding from 2000 to 2006. And the NHPRC Advisory Committee was especially key in guiding the center through that process. The project really laid out the groundwork for the current model of shared systems, shared services, and processing that we work with now. And it enabled us to plan and implement our shared collection management and access system, begin processing partner backlogs, allowed for retrospective conversion, disaster planning, and integrated public services in a shared reading room. And as the senior manager for archival services, I'll speak now to specifically what we do for the partners on the processing and general archives front. We currently have a team of 9 center archivists who arrange and describe archival collections that are processing or reprocessing priorities for the partners. And we work at a rate of about 2 to 3 linear feet a week. And our staff has a wide range of education, subject expertise, and language skills because the partner collections are multilingual, and so are our archivists. So we've got fluency in Yiddish, German, Russian, Hungarian, a little bit of French, a little bit Hebrew, some Polish. And our processing work is largely grant-funded. And we're currently processing collections on 4 different grants, 2 of which allow us to simply clear out the processing backlog at the partners and make hidden collections accessible. And two of which are thematic, focusing on Holocaust-related and performing arts-related collections. And we settle on the collection lists for those grants in close consultation with the partners, of course. And when processing, we work very closely with the partners with constant input and communication with them. There's many steps in the workflow that vary partner by partner, as they have pretty divergent processing traditions and preferences. But we have developed extensive documentation of all the variations and our approaches to those variations in the form of a 40-page processing guide, which is kind of our Bible, our processing Bible. And we hand encode our EAD finding aids following center and partner encoding practices, which were again established on the NHPRC project years ago. And we use partner-specific EAD to HTML style sheets developed during the NHPRC project, which were largely based on NYU style sheets at the time. And we currently have a very active EAD committee that is revising and reviewing our practices and style sheets on an ongoing basis, again, in consultation with partners and with partner collaboration on that committee. And we basically, since the center started processing partner collections 12 years ago, we've worked through 5,000 linear feet of about 600 collections, which ultimately comes out to about 1/6 of the total holdings there at the center among the partners. So, and we're planning to process about 2,000 linear feet in the next 3 years as well on top of that. So basically we've helped clear out most of the backlog at 4 of the 5 partners, and we're often working on new acquisitions at this point. And a lot of our processing work has then sort of enabled digitization either by the center or the partners. For example, the Leo Beck Institute has a very large scale digitization project to basically work through all of their materials. And the fact that we've processed a good chunk of those has helped them greatly in pushing forward their own priorities and that massive undertaking. I could go into more on the processing archivist end, or I could hop into digitization.
I don't know. What would the group like? I mean, this is a shared services podcast as well. So do you want to, maybe
we can introduce everybody else and kind of go through talk about what some of the other roles are and everything, and circle back around to some of that other, the actual work of what CHH is doing.
Okay, I guess I'll go. I'm the Senior Reference Services Librarian for Special Collections, which means essentially I'm responsible for reading room management. We are an extremely busy environment. In the Special Collections reading room alone, we can accommodate 32 readers at a time, and we frequently hit that during the summer months. In a month like October, we didn't have one day where we had less than 20 simultaneous users. And we basically do public service for all 5 partners, which then frees up the partner staff, again, as Rachel was saying, similar to what processing does, then they do not have to have dedicated staff that sit and do public services for extended shifts every day. So while none of us maybe have the in-depth knowledge of the partner collections as the curators or the librarians or the archivists do, we're essentially all sort of 5 partner generalists. So we do a lot of the initial patron triage. We help people figure out what materials they want to see. You know, we frequently call down partner staff for consultations if people have detailed questions about collections that we can't answer. But again, essentially, we're doing that frontline reference. And also from a patron perspective, it's a huge innovation because, well, before the center, people used to go to these five different locations, which was clearly labor intensive. In the beginning days of the center, there would be five and somewhere upwards of seven or eight librarians and archivists all sitting behind the reference desk because each partner sent down designated staff to do public services. And some partners would send down both a librarian and an archivist. But everyone's looking in the same universal OPAC. So it was extremely confusing. You know, I liked it as sort of like reference bingo. You know, people would come up with 10 call slips and who gets what? You know, well, this person gets two and this person gets three. And also partners had different policies as far as photocopying, digital photography, how many items you could look at a time. So one of the things that we really aimed to do, particularly when I got there, because I came from a special collections background rather than a Jewish history background, was really to implement more special collections related controls in the reading room, which has been excellent, again, for the patrons and also for the partners as well, because we're also responsible for the reading room security of all of these items. And in such a high traffic environment, you know, that's very important. But again, the patrons really like the single consolidated point of service because it just means that they can come up to one person and say, this is what I want to look at. You know, how can you help me? And again, I mean, our partners are all, you know, very venerable institutions in their own right, but they're all still small to medium-sized cultural heritage institutions, and it's extremely expensive to maintain dedicated public services staff all the time. So that's one of the great ways that the center takes that burden off. And as I said, we have two reading rooms. We have collections, but we also have genealogy, which is also an extremely high traffic area where we have a dedicated genealogy librarian, as well as, you know, we have reading room assistants as well who sit there and do that kind of really granular reference work because genealogy is extremely labor-intensive reference work. So those are some of the ways I think that we really help the partner institutions, and that's a really a good example of us collaborating to really sort of, you know, to better serve the different organizations. And I also would like to say, I think the center is really exceptional that way because it's really rare to hear about even two organizations having a successful collaboration and partnership, and that we have six. And they're not six different departments. Like when you go to the Morgan, you know, there's 20 different collections and they're all in the same reading room and you deal with one public services librarian. But here, there are six different institutions. So the fact that we can all, you know, come together and manage to standardize policies and work on collaborative projects and all be in one OPAC and one reading room, I think is really exceptional. I mean, it's been an evolution over time, but I think it's a really sort of exceptional model.
I don't think we got your name.
Oh, sorry. Melanie Myers.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
We'll have to annotate that in the sound.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Lauren Bradley. I am the systems librarian at the center. And as Melanie had mentioned, one of the amazing triumphs of the center's 13-year history is we got all of the partners' records into one single ILS. In addition to one single ILS, we also have one digital asset manager. We have a discovery layer that sits on top of both of those things. We have a shared museum management software system. And we also have a link resolver, a shared link resolver for all our electronic resources. And that was a 6 to 8 year long project, depending on who you ask. when you want
that project done?
Is that project ever done? Well, as much as it's ever done. It was officially launched sometime in 2006, 2007, and the first task, of course, was selecting an ILS. And not only are we working with, you know, six different voices who all have their input, our collections also have lots of special challenges. First of all, we had to find an ILS that featured, you know, that could support non-Roman characters, which in 2000 wasn't as standard as it is now. Many of our collections are in Hebrew characters, both Hebrew and Yiddish, and we have a fair amount of Cyrillic. And beyond that, all of the partners had their existing records in various formats. Some of the partners actually had some kind of, you know, early generation ILS. Some of them had them in like proprietary database software. Some of them they had in Excel, you know, worksheets. And then some of them just had a physical card catalog. And the the data in those things might be in English. They might be in Hebrew, Yiddish, Russian, maybe all of those on the same card. So, you know, it made the automation process a little hairy, but we got to debut it. And then after that, we implemented our digital asset manager. And then our latest implementation was in 2009, we revealed our discovery layer, which was actually really helpful because we do have all these different software repositories. We had three different OPACs that all related to different pieces of software, and now all of that is searchable in one friendly place.
That sounds like a challenge.
It was and is.
And as for what I do, I'm Felicity Corkill, the Associate Conservator. I'm, I suppose, another of what you'd call the shared services. I manage the conservation lab at the centre. I've actually only been with the centre since February this year, so I don't have as much of a knowledge of the institutional history as my colleagues. But it's my understanding that conservation was a fairly early priority for the centre. I think in the early 2000s there was a conservation lab established in the building. And there were two conservators that provided basic conservation services to preserve the archival and library materials that the partners brought them. Things such as cleaning and repairing, rebinding where necessary, a lot of rehousing into new folders and new boxes, and encapsulation of documents, as well as repairs to the extent that sort of the time and quantity of material would allow. As the evolution of the centre progressed, a big renovation was planned for the shared services on the basement level of the centre, which included the digitisation lab, the archive processing lab and the conservation lab. And at about that time, one of the conservators left and the other was engaged by one of the partners to work with their collections. So the conservation lab was in hiatus for a couple of years while the renovation happened. And it reopened with my employment at the start of the year. And I have spent the year re-establishing those same basic conservation services of repair and rehousing, as well as starting to try to develop more wider scale preservation programs such as environmental monitoring. I've been working with the existing disaster recovery and preparedness committee to work on disaster preparedness plans. Started some collection surveying in addition to what was already being done by the archival team, and assisting also with my preservation knowledge for exhibitions that are increasing as our spaces in the centre are developed to take more exhibitions. So basically my aim is to assist any partner and all of the collections with as much of my preservation knowledge as I can. And if I don't have an answer, then do the research to see what I can find out to help. And at this stage, all five partners are bringing me collection material for repair and treatment. And I've assisted all of them with questions that they have about the preservation concerns of their collection material. So it's been a really good collaboration in the 9 or so months since I've been here thus far.
So my big question is, how do you do it? I mean, really, you bring up about how difficult it is just to get two institutions together. And I've seen this with state consortiums, where it's just something as basic as one institution has a DSpace installation and they let other people share it. And even I've done work with military archives, and even where there's a chain of command that should be followed, it's difficult to get people to communicate and collaborate in that way.
We do it really carefully. Yeah. That would probably be
gingerly.
No, but you're right. I mean, I was at a conference earlier this year at the Library of Congress. It was all about sharing and collaboration. And there were examples of successful collaborations and examples of not so successful collaborations. But one of the things that that I talked about that was the idea that the reason why collaboration is so hard is because it involves a level of risk, which people are often unwilling to take. Because if then the collaboration goes badly, there can be ill feelings on both sides, or then a reluctance to do it again. And it also means you have to let go. And that is very hard for people to do, and it's very hard for institutions to do, especially when you're dealing with some of these things which are relatively high stakes. You know, you're talking about priceless artifacts, you're talking about staff time, which in these days is increasingly priceless, or, you know, even your carefully curated data. So I think for us, you know, and I've only been there since 2011, but it's really been an evolution over time with trial and error, you know, seeing what works, you know, trying to build on that. There has to be a lot of listening. I know it sounds sort of, you know, cliche, but it's really true, because often when there are difficulties, it's really due to miscommunication or to, it can be extremely difficult to disseminate information across six different institutions to every single person that needs to know about it, since we're all working on collaborative projects. But we've gotten better at that over time, I think. And I also think, you know, right now at the center, particularly with the four of us, there's a group of people that work really well together and work really well to serve the partners. It's become easier, I think, over time. I don't know if you would.
I agree. And I would say that really the biggest factor is trust. And I will have been at the center in the spring for 4 years. And I actually was first employed by one of the partner institutions and then was offered a position with the center 2 years ago. And so I've seen various levels of trust, and when trust is high, things work really smoothly, and when trust is not high, that's where we run into roadblocks and where projects, you know, start to fall apart a little. And you know, I agree with Melanie. I think everyone here tries very hard to build that trust, and whether it's Felicity being trusted with somebody's physical items, or Rachel, same thing. Melanie is trusted with their patrons, and they trust me with their data. So there is a lot of risk going on, as Melanie mentioned. And so we try to take care of whatever it is that has been trusted to us. But then, you know, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes there are low levels of trust in different, you know, arenas where we have no influence or say, and that can spill over to our work. So the best we can do is try to take care of what has been entrusted to us.
Are there particular ways of building that trust? And I think this isn't just relevant for cross-institutional collaboration. Uh-huh. I mean, this is within an institution where you have different departments, sure, that are working together.
I think we have all done this to different degrees, is if there seems to be a contentious situation with either a partner or a specific department, or maybe even one individual, I think we start by trying just to take on a small, like a very small project or a very minor thing, and, you know, trying to be honest about what we can do, how quickly it can be accomplished, and then deliver on that. And, you know, when we can actually deliver on what we say we will do, I think that's the first step towards building trust.
No, definitely. I think a lot of these projects started with baby steps. You know, I know with me in the reading room, like I said, I'm very proud of the fact that over 3 years now, we've managed to standardize all reading room policies pretty much across all the partners whose collections we serve, but that was literally done in incremental steps, you know, slowly. The first step was, after I started there, you know, I went to all the partners and said, listen, as a special collections librarian, I gotta tell you, we have too much material circulating at one time. I need to get a better handle on it because I care, you know, because I love working with your materials. What can we all live with? give me a number. And then we all came up with, okay, two books or one archival box. Instituted that. Then we started with some other, you know, other steps. Well, that went well a couple months later. Well, can we try this? And generally speaking, you know, because the demands were not unreasonable, and because, again, we'd built up trust, you know, after we'd sort of performed one step and that went well, then it was a lot easier for people to say, you know what, they know what they're doing down there. They have our best interests at heart. Usually the innovations that we institute tend to save other people work. So once also that became, you know, well, you know, better known, well, that's great. You know, yeah, let's definitely institute that. Because basically, you know, like I said, my two jobs are to serve the patrons and to serve the partners. So pretty much anything that I try to institute serves one or the other. And now we have a relatively open dialogue that there's been some projects that 3 years ago, people would have said there's no way that would get off the ground. And they not only got off the ground, but were completed to like the barcoding of the reading room.
And were successful.
That was successful. Yeah. You know, we just went to all the partners and said, we have to barcode everything in the reading room. Can you trust us to do it? We're gonna do it ourselves. You don't have to do anything. And 3 years ago, they would have said, no, we work on our own materials. We'll do it. But because we had built up a level of trust, they said, yeah, you know what? That's a great idea. Let's do it. And we did it relatively quickly. So, but again, it was, I'm sure it was like that with processing as well. I mean, with you guys, you mm-hmm. had to build up sort of, you did some collections well, and then they mm-hmm. were more willing to.
Definitely, and it's an ongoing process. I mean, when I started at the center, there were just three of us processing archivists, and we were actually spread throughout the building at the different partner organizations physically. And then over time, since I've been here, most of us have sort of centralized to one space, and the partners trust us with their collections in that space, and don't, you know, they don't have to be hovering over us. We communicate constantly via email, phone, meetings, and the like about any issues that come up during the course of processing. With the exception of one partner, we still do sit in their spaces, and that works well for us and well for them. And so,
I think communication is key, and, yeah. and that's what I've tried to do. When I came at the start of the year, I was really starting from afresh since the Conservation Lab hadn't been operational for a few years. And I basically treated it as if I were working with five private clients. As a conservator, I do have both an institutional and a private conservation background, so I was familiar with the processes. And private conservation is very much about informing your client of, first of all, what is possible to do to the artifact, and then even going to the extent of giving them a written proposal so that they can view that and decide whether or not they think that is acceptable before you start interfering, as they may see it, with their artifacts. Providing them updates on the progression of any treatment or project work that you're doing. And then finally, when you return the item, talking through, you know, what changed, what was different. So there's a lot of one-on-one consultation with the custodians and looking over the artifacts, and then finally giving them a treatment report so that they have that documentation of what occurred, so that everything's in the open as much as possible, and they feel like they're part of the process and that nothing's happening that they are not in control of.
Also, one thing that Felicity has done, which has been great, is she also has done this whole sort of educational initiative for all five partners about things like disaster planning, which has been really nice sort of, you know, for all of us to have that kind of larger scale, you know, educational and planning initiatives that benefit everybody. And I think that really helps out a lot too, because then we have these meetings where all the partners can come and everybody can be heard about, you know, what they're worried about for if we have another Sandy-like disaster or, you know, whatever. And I think things like that help to build trust, you know, like the ANTC.
Sure. We had talked about we wanted to bring up the ANTC. This is our Access and New Technology Committee that was started by my predecessor, three or four years ago. Actually, I think it was born out of when she was trying to implement our discovery layer. They needed to do a cross-institution, you know, search committee. And, you know, at the time, many of the staff didn't even really know what a discovery layer was. So that evolved into the Access and New Technology Committee, which anyone is invited to. At first, it was really librarians, archivists, curators, you know, people that I like to refer to as collections staff. But since has grown, and now we have people who come from development and from the administration. Every once in a while, if it's relevant to his job, our director of security will even come. But basically, we do many things. Everyone is invited, so anyone from any of the institutions, regardless of what their job title is. And we have monthly information sessions where we'll pick a topic and somebody presents on it. And this can range from, you know, linked open data to ebooks to disaster planning to what else do we do? All sorts of things.
I mean, that might be a better question.
And then on top of that, we also have six subcommittees related to the greater committee who are all trying to grapple with different center-wide issues. So we have an authorities committee that is looking at standardizing form genre headings. We have a disaster planning committee. We have a preservation committee. We have a social media committee. We have a brand new Wikipedia committee, which I'm very excited about. They'll be launching in 2014. And then on top of that, I also try to, through ANTC, try to arrange for professional development opportunities, most of which are webinars. But every once in a while, we can get like an outside speaker to come in and present on something or do a little training on something.
And we also have the Shared Services Committee.
Oh, we have the Shared Services Committee, which Melanie will be chairing.
Which is brand new. And again, so that the partners can come and talk to all of us that work for the center about what can we do.
And I think the committee's been really successful because before the committee, there was no real forum for the staff of different partners to communicate. I mean, they could always email each other, but besides that, there was no standard way for them to talk. And there was a lot of communication going, you know, at the way higher up level. So the executive directors would meet and talk with each other and, you know, the boards, because each of these institutions has their own board. So the boards might get together or send representatives and they might communicate. But these kind of more middle people, the department heads, the support staff, they weren't really communicating with each other beyond kind of like bumping into each other in the elevator. And it was very common for the partners to not even know the names of the other staff. And I mean, we're not really that big of a building. There's maybe 150 people that work in the building, and everyone was kind of siloed off.
Yeah, so. I would say so. But ANTC, I think, has really helped that. I think because it is so open.
Yes.
And that anybody can also, I mean, Lauren regularly puts out a call and says, what do you want to do? You know, what are topics that people want covered? And then she goes out and finds webinars, you know, or speakers or people in-house. Because also a lot of times, too, what's been great about it is individual partners get to talk about their own collections, which is something that I think it's really easy, you know, if you're a curator or a library or archives head of one of these collections, rightly so, you concentrate on your own collection. That is your job. You know, you, if I was curator of a collection, that's probably all I would think about. But it's really nice frequently to hear for all the partners to get together and hear from one partner about, you know, a project they're doing or even the history of the institutions. You know, when the head librarian from the EVO gave a wonderful talk about the history of the EVO Library, it was great. And since I do a lot of education and outreach, having students in and doing show and tells with the materials, it was absolutely invaluable to me. And I think to other people as well. And it also, it just leads to some of that thawing of, you know, that we're, because again, these are established institutions in their own right long before it was the center. So I think it definitely leads to some thawing and some more, you know, more collaboration,
well,
just more talking.
And the funny thing about ANTC is, although everyone's collections are very different than each other, I think it's been kind of a real, like, eureka moment, realizing we all have the same issues and the same problem. And, for example, the social media committee, which started last year, almost every partner had the same exact problem, where it was one person for each institution who was in charge of all the social media accounts. And almost all of them had kind of been appointed to do this from higher up. And, you know, they were expected to do this on top of all their other job duties. And there was a lot of, you know, griping. So we had this meeting, and the first meeting turned into like group therapy and a lot of complaining about, you know, I don't know how I'm supposed to fit this in. And, you know, I've been in charge of the Facebook account for 6 months and we only have whatever 60 people who like us, and the ED is coming down, and why don't more people like our Facebook page? And I don't know, you know. And they were able to talk to each other, and there was one partner in particular who has a very successful Facebook page, and there's another partner who has a very successful Tumblr. So, you know, there was actual space for like some information exchange, and we actually all worked together to put together a social media policy. And, you know, and because we're a Jewish institution, again, we have special considerations. What is the proper procedure if somebody leaves an anti-Semitic remark on your Facebook page? Like, what is the appropriate way to deal with that? Do we need to call NYPD? Does that count as a threat? You know, some serious issues. But I think it's been a good, you know, and that's just one example that I think is very indicative of other projects and programs that we have managed to put together cross-institutionally.
I mean, I also think that you know, not necessarily the center model, because I think it'd be very hard for five other institutions to all sort of get together under one roof. I think, honestly, I wish more people were open to it. I think there's probably a lot of smaller institutions that have either similar thematic content or similarly like geographically located that might be able to benefit from it. But even in, you know, just a regular sort of special collections environment, where, again, it becomes easy for collections to become very sort of self-contained, you know, something like the ANTC is a good model, you know, for saying, well, everyone from all the collections can just come and talk. And yeah, I mean, we're for the most part, we're all sort of sharing the same problems. They're not unique, really. And often, like you said, sometimes it's just good to even just talk about it.
Right.
You know, bibliotherapy or whatever. You know, I think that was really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Especially like in New York, there are so many collections, there are so many archives, and lots of them are small, and they may have just one archivist or one person mm-hmm. who's kind of put in charge of it. And there's so much potential for the kinds of things that CJH does to be a guide for other organizations in that way, to combine forces, you know, not even if they're, you know, have a similar type of focus as CJH does, but just to combine together as some kind of, well, we're a little bit similar, or we can help each other out, or.
Well, and I think it's very smart financially, because, you know, most small institutions, you know, if your staff only has six to 10 people, you know, you might not be able to afford to employ a full-time systems librarian or a full-time, you know, reading room reference services librarian or a conservationist or, you know, so, and on top of that too, you know, you look at things that are very particular to New York, like the rent. You know, if your budget every year is getting eaten more and more by, you know, renting a townhouse in Manhattan or, you know, whatever, what have you. I think this model also allows small institutions to implement things that they would never implement. And Rachel was saying this the other day about Leo Beck and their digital archive project. Do you want to expand on that?
Sure. So DigiBeck is their project to basically digitize everything in their collections. And we've processed probably a couple thousand feed, which they have since digitized. And again, this is the kind of thing that would have taken them a lot more processing archivists to work through on their own. So we saved them, you know, potentially years of work on pushing that forward.
Yeah, they never would have been able to do this big digitization program if the processing lab and Rachel's staff hadn't cleared out their backlog. Because then it just freed them up to do this really ambitious, I mean, Digiback is, it's big.
It's, yeah, it's I huge. Think it's like 90% of their archive, right as it stands right
it's
now.
It's all the memoirs, and it's huge.
And they, and, you know, it's great because they were able to go out and hire some really talented staff who have, like, very advanced technological skills. And then it's actually very reciprocal because then someone like me who works for the center can actually turn to their staff and say, you know, we're having this problem with, like, our digital asset manager, or, you know, we have this question about XSLT. Like, you know, personally, I know nothing about XSLT except for the name of it and that I don't know how to use it. But I can, they have some staff who are very fluent in it and can, you know, then benefit the greater center community. And that knowledge gets passed on to some of the other partners who maybe don't have the same robust digital preservation, you know, program going on.
So I guess I have a question sort of about how, what are the challenges of, and how do you manage sort of the prioritization of these things? So you mentioned a lot of the processing work is grant funded or driven by grant funding. You know, conservation is probably driven very much by acquisitions and material types. And since you have museum objects and archival collections and rare books. You know, in a shared services model, obviously somebody is coming first, and if grant funding is funding this processing, then maybe this other collection is getting less attention at that moment. And obviously giving things up, you mentioned, is very important in these sorts of collaborations. So I was just curious how that sort of impacted the services, or, you know, the conversations and the difficulties of managing that.
I could speak specifically to the processing end. So the way that we used to structure the processing grants were such that every partner had very equal representation in the grants. And I think at one point then it might have even been rent-based. So each partner is paying rent to the center. So I think according to how much rent they were paying was roughly how many collections we were processing. At this point, we've moved through so much of the material that we're just focusing on those partners who have backlogs or who have a sudden, you know, large new acquisition that's come in. Or that just in general, you know, this collection's outside of the skills of the staff they have at the time, so we'll take that on kind of thing. So it's very fluid on the processing end. And we're in general open to whoever is most open to us. So there's certain partners who are a lot more sort of
responsive.
The word, yes, responsive.
Desperate.
And who come to us with projects too, and ask us to sort of work together with them on it.
From a conservation perspective, I'm lucky in that that thus far I haven't been completely inundated with requests, so I'm able to take them as a sort of a first come, first served basis, and every item that comes in is booked under a job number, and I can just progress through those in order. But I do anticipate before too much longer that I will have far more material than I can cope with. I mean, the collections are really quite extensive, and there's no way you can repair every page in an archive. So when that comes, we will certainly have to deal with it. Otherwise, people could be waiting years for things that come down, and that sort of thing's not going to be acceptable. So that will be a work in progress.
In systems, I kind of have the easy way out because 90% of the time, if there's a problem with somebody's records, then everybody's records have the same problem. Right. You know, the OPAC goes down, everyone is equally inconvenienced. And then for the other 10% of the time, you know, I just try to, well, one, I'm lucky in that the partners aren't really overly demanding or anything. And when they come to me with a project, I try to be very realistic about what I can do and my timeline. And then, you know, if I do have a lot on my plate, you know, I will say, well, you know, I don't think I'm going to be able to start that for another 3 months or until next year or, you know, until after the holidays. So can we talk about it again then? And that's worked so far.
See, for me, it's a little different because, I mean, I work on some projects, but I'm not sort of as project oriented in terms of what everybody else here does. My first priority is that I have to treat all the partners fairly. You know, I joke that I'm the mother. They can't say that, like, I have one favorite child, you know. So, but I also feel like that's built up trust, you know, over the years that, you know, I try to treat everybody fairly, everybody's, you know, collections with the same amount of care. But a lot of what I end up doing is help them set priorities. Because working in public service, you know, I'm the one that sees when someone comes from the stacks, this is in really bad shape. Maybe this needs to go down to conservation. You know, those are the conversations then that I have with the librarians or the archivists. Like sometimes we, you know, we'll pull a box from the stacks, hasn't been pulled in 10 years, it's got mold. You know, we're the ones that see that. You know, and again, and partners over the years have asked me to help them with these kind of things. Like Leo Beck Institute, the chief archivist, came to me about 2 years ago and said, look, can you just send me a report every week of what actual physical paper collections are pulled? Because they were just, you know, digitizing. And they're like, because that'll help us set priorities for digitization. If we know what's being used, we just want one consolidated report every week. And so I started sending them that, and they said that was a huge help then in terms of setting their priorities for what was going down to the digital lab or what was going to be microfilmed. So that's more what my, you know, more what my function is in public services. I sort of see what comes through from everybody's collections over my desk, which is pretty, which is probably the best part of my job. You know, as a special collections librarian, it's actually pretty thrilling to see some of the things that come through. And then, you know, I just try and work with them about, you know, what's heavy use. You know, again, what maybe should be digitized, what patrons are asking to be digitized. And I work over time. I work more and more with partners on that kind of thing. But.
Another good collaboration is what's happening on the basement level of the building where the digitization, conservation and archive processing labs are all held, where we're increasingly getting more large-scale projects that are coming through archive processing and need to be digitized. So there's, first of all, a lot of communication there. And then, depending on the condition of the material, I might be asked to help either repair it or prepare it or stabilize it for the digitization process so that it can go through safely. And that's been a really good development this year in terms of the communication that we've had, even just among centre staff, to get these large-scale projects through.
And for us, last year, public service and systems were consolidated into one department, which might seem strange, but it works really well.
Yeah, and it was, because I remember when they combined us. And I mean, when I say they combined us, really, we had the same person who was overseeing both of us. And as the, I am the systems department. So, you know, it was a little weird for me to be sitting with what I felt like. I'm sitting on this reading room meeting, and they're all discussing an issue that has nothing to do with me. I mean, I didn't mind, but it was just a little like, is it really appropriate use of my staff time to be here? This is strange. But as we continued, it became a very, it became very clear that systems and the reading room have a lot more in common than they don't. And it even became, you know, the reading room librarians would complain about, oh, we've had this problem with the computers for, it's such a pain. And, you know, I'd pipe up and say, oh, I can fix that. And they're, or like, oh, why don't we just do this? And, you know, I could suggest a technological solution that maybe hadn't even occurred to them. And previously, whereas that would have been a process where they would, you know, one, somebody would have to think, even consider that a solution, and then submit that to me or to the director of IT, and then it would get passed down to me, and then I'd have to go and meet with them and figure out what the problem, you know, it turned a very long process into a 5 minute, oh, that's the problem you're having, that, oh, I have a solution for you, do you know, take me 5 minutes to fix, or take me a half hour to work on. And
but also some
problem's
of the stuff,
gone,
you know, that you worked on, like the big deduping projects and like some of the catalog cleanup, that nobody really, it never really occurred to anybody how much that affects public services. You know, but then we started having these conversations, you know, where when she started talking about the deduping, and my immediate response was, oh, I can't, I'm so happy you're doing that. You have no idea how confusing it is for people, because we're the ones that see how people are looking at the catalog, how they're interacting with the digital surrogates as well as the actual objects. So it's really helpful for us to have more input into things like how we're doing the digital asset management, you know, how we're maintaining the catalog. You know, it's really, because we're the ones that are getting the patron feedback. Really, yeah. Not so much this
year. And I mean, it can be as simple as the librarian saying, you know, this one paragraph on the OPAC just
totally confuses the patrons.
Yeah, can
and, you remember that? You know, I have a library science degree, so I'm like, what's confusing? So, I mean, I've even gone to them and said, you know, what do you call the OPAC? You know, or what do you call, like, when you're talking to patrons, what is the label you use for the discovery layer? And, you know, oh, we call it this. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can work with that language. That's easy.
Rachel, I wanted to ask more about the processing Bible. I mean, this is interesting to me. Just from dealing with this, dealing with processing from the point of view of audiovisual materials and, you know, just trying to think about how to apply that and trying to think then about processing for several different institutions. So is this Bible, it's a centralized, it's like everybody then gets the same processing, the same level and the same approach, or how does this work?
No. So actually the way that the whole guide is structured is sort of by the sort of, I guess, the larger steps of the processing workflow. And then within that, we sort of have partner by partner instructions under sort of each point. So if they have different ways of dealing with oversized materials, we've got a section on oversized materials and how to describe those or what kind of folders to use for those or what kind of storage those will ultimately, you know, go into. And the approval process is also different for different partners. What we'll do on the records end is also different for different partners according to what kind of staff they have on hand and what kind of responsibilities we have taken on. And they also have different descriptive practices surrounding certain collections. You know, LBI, the Leo Beck Institute, primarily has sort of small personal papers collections, and they have some specific subject terms they use for those collections that we apply. So those kind of like little elements are all throughout this 40-page Bible.
And do they set the priorities for what's processed then?
They do, yes, together with what staff we have available at the time. Hmm. Sort of some choreography that goes on.
Uh-huh.
And is there any sort of feedback on acquisition? So it sounds like sort of the curators and the appraisal process happens sort of, does that happen without the input of the larger shared services staff, or how much, you know, there's obviously sort of conservation needs, there's processing needs that, you know, could be taken to an account before acquiring something?
Mostly. They all have different collection development policies, right, and scopes. What's really...
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting, though, is there is another successful collaboration that is... It's not really related to ANTC because it predates ANTC, but it's the Collection Development Committee. And people from the center, including myself and Melanie and a few other key people, attend that meeting, but that is really more partner driven. And what it is it's representatives from each institution, and they focus more on electronic resources, purchasing either databases or journals that will benefit the whole. But there is a certain amount of collaboration going on just to make sure that they aren't duplicating areas. And I mean, I think it's more a concern of finances, and, you know, we don't want to spend a bunch of money on things that already exist in the building and are available to patrons.
Yeah, and the e-resources are available for partner staff, but they're also available to the public so long as you're in the reading room. So these are things that are specifically bought with to supplement all the primary source resources that are held by all the partners. So, and honestly, you know, again, it's easy when you're curating your own collection to just only see that. But I think what's great about stuff like collection development is they realize there's a lot more crossover than people realize. So a lot of these resources, you know, one partner will suggest it and then another partner will say, that's great.
Yeah, that would work great.
That would work great because we just acquired X, Y, and Z, or we're actively collecting in this area now. So that's been a pretty good, committee and use of sort of, you know, center resources.
Has that led to collaboration with institutions outside of CJH? or does that
we have
sort of
done plan? Some. But
well, yeah, all of the partners have collaborations with other institutions that may involve CJH or may not.
Particularly digital
projects. Especially digital projects. And, you know, it just kind of depends on the nature. For example, the Leo Beck Institute does a lot of collaborations with organizations in Germany, which, you know, if you are a staff member at the American Jewish Historical Society, that may not be so relevant to your work.
Hugo Library is collaborating, I think, with the National Library of Lithuania.
Yeah.
So it really depends sort of on what the collection areas are, what they're digitizing.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, I think, has to do sort of with creating these larger digital collections. I think the Hugo one in particular is like unification sort of this one collection, that we have some books here, they have mm-hmm. some there, so they're going to digitize them all and then put them into it, I think. Does that sound right?
Yeah, something like that.
There's so many different projects, I can't keep track.
In-house at CJH, our collaborations tend to be more, if you will, infrastructure-based, whereas the partners, and I mean, CJH does its own collaborations too, with other institutions tend to be more content-based, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Should I do a final question?
Sure.
So which partner is the most annoying?
Well, I was going to say, you know, we're all human. So what are the things that sort of frustrate us about the process? I mean, it works very well, but it's not perfect. So
yeah.
Without naming names, what do people think are the greatest frustrations?
Earlier, Felicity brought up the word interfering, and I think that is a very good word. There's a very, very fine line between interfering and supporting. And sometimes you think you are supporting, or you're being supportive, you're being helpful, and it comes across as interference.
It might actually be interference.
I like to think I don't interfere with people's work, but sometimes it comes across that way.
And also, I will say, you know, special collections are notoriously resistant to change. That is just something I see with my friends, my colleagues. You know, you go to a conference and everybody sits around at the bar, of course, and this is all that you hear. You know, I can't get this project off the ground. There's, you know, special collections. It's changing now because there's a lot more younger people that have entered the field. I mean, it's embarrassing. I'm 40 and I'm probably considered one of the younger people. But we're more open to issues of opening up access. So that's something I think that we see in some of these institutions who all have long institutional histories. I mean, the American Jewish Historical Society is the oldest ethnic organization in the country. It's been around since the mid-1800s, I think, or late 1800s. So that's a long institutional history. And so sometimes there are issues of, well, this is the way we've always done it. And so that's when you have to have the conversations about, but that's not the way that we should, but there's better ways to do it. Or let's try and talk about, you know, increasing access here. But again, that's not just us. That's really, I think, a hurdle that a lot of special collections and archives are really working to overcome. You know, this gatekeeper sort of, well, we guard the things, you know, we have all the things and we're gonna keep, you know, everybody out. So I think that's, sometimes we run up against that a bit.
It's across the field, it really seems like, and especially when you start getting into digitization too, and the issues there. And
I think digitization is the thing that's really changed it in special collections, because you're having more people like digital humanities, people that are coming in and saying, we want to work with your collections. Mm-hmm. We want to make, you know, digital facsimiles and do different things with them. You know, but again, you still have to overcome that institutional sort of suspicion and roadblock about, well, that's not the way we've done it. Are we sure? And I think, that's not new to us. That's not unique to us in any way. But I feel like that's more what I run up against.
Well, we won't put anybody else in the spot then. But thank you for joining us. This is really informative and interesting. So
thanks
for appreciate
having
your
us.
Time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. I think that's it.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right. Cut.